Introduction to The Winds of Change. I have edited two anthologies along with Alice Lawrence, a hard-working, intelligent, and good-looking woman with whom it is a pleasure to work. The first was a mystery anthology, the second a science fiction anthology, and in both cases the stories that were included were originals written for the volumes in question. What's more, in each case the identity of the author was hidden, and the reader was asked to guess that identity if he cared to. I wrote one of the stories in the science fiction anthology, and that story was The Winds of Change. I wonder, though, if I managed to hide my identity. A list of the contributors was placed at the beginning of the book, and I imagine anyone searching for an Asimovian story could scarcely fail to pick this one out of the lot. But that doesn't matter. I honestly feel that in some ways this story, which the alphabet has fortunately brought to the very end of the story list, is the strongest in the book. That's why I'm using it for the title of the collection as a whole, aside from the fact I like the title. In fact, I consider the ending so strong that I'm going to forgo the final word I would ordinarily put in. I want no anticlimactic addition to the last page of this book as it now stands. And don't look at it now. Read the story. Story 21. The Winds of Change. Jonas Dinsmore walked into the president's room of the faculty club in a manner completely characteristic of himself, as though conscious of being in a place in which he belonged, but in which he was not accepted. The belonging showed in the sureness of his stride and the casual noise of his feet as he walked. The non-acceptance lay in his quick look from side to side as he entered, a quick summing up of the enemy's presence. He was an associate professor of physics, and he was not liked. There were two others in the room, and Dinsmore might well have considered them enemies without being thought paranoid for doing so. One was Horatio Adams, the aging chairman of the department, who, without ever having done any single thing that was remarkable, had yet accumulated a vast respect for the numerous unremarkable but perfectly correct things he had done. The other was Carl Muller, whose work on grand unified field theory had put him in line for the Nobel Prize, he thought, probably, and the presidency of the university, he thought, certainly. It was hard to say which prospect Dinsmore found more distasteful. It was quite fair to say he detested Muller. Dinsmore seated himself at one corner of the couch, which was old, slippery, and chilly. The two comfortable armchairs were taken by the others. Dinsmore smiled. He frequently smiled, though his face never seemed either friendly or pleased as a result, though there was nothing in the smile that was not the normal drawing back of the corners of the mouth. It invariably had a chilling effect on those at whom he aimed the gesture. His round face, his sparse but carefully combed hair, his full lips, would all have taken on joviality with such a smile, or should have, but didn't. Adams stirred with what seemed to be a momentary spasm of irritation crossing his long New Englandish face. Muller, his hair nearly black, and his eyes an incongruous blue, seemed impassive. Dinsmore said, "I intrude, gentlemen, I know. Yet I have no choice. I have been asked by the Board of Trustees to be present. It may seem to you to be a cruel action, perhaps. I am sure you expect, Muller, that at any moment a communication will be received from the trustees to the effect that you have been named for the presidency. It would seem proper that the renowned Professor Adams, your mentor and patron, should know of it. But why, Muller, should they reserve a similar privilege for me, your humble and ever-failing rival? I suspect, in fact, that your first act as president, Muller, would be to inform me that it would be in all ways better if I would seek another position elsewhere, since my appointment will not be renewed past this academic year. It might be convenient to have me on the spot, in order that there be no delay. It would be unkind, but efficient. You look troubled, both of you. I may be unjust. My instant dismissal may not be in your mind. You may have been willing to wait till tomorrow. Can it be that it is the trustees who would rather be quick, and who would rather have me on the spot? It doesn't matter. Either way, it would seem that you are in, and I am out. And perhaps that seems just. The respected head of a great department, approaching the evening of his career, with his brilliant protégé, whose grasp of concept and whose handling of mathematics is unparalleled, are ready for the laurels, while I, without respect or honor. Since this is so, It is kind of you to let me talk without interrupting. I have a feeling that the message we wait for may not arrive for some minutes, for an hour, perhaps. A presentiment. The trustees themselves would not be averse to building suspense. This is their moment in the sun, their fleeting time of glory. And since the time must be past, I am willing to speak. Some, before execution, are granted a last meal. Some a last cigarette. I, a last few words. You needn't listen, I suppose, or even bother to look interested. Thank you. The look of resignation, Professor Adams, I will accept as agreement. Professor Muller's slight smile, let us say, of contempt, will also do. You will not blame me, I know, for wishing the situation were changed. In what way? A good question. I would not wish to change my character and personality. It may be unsatisfactory, but it is mine. Nor would I change the politic efficiency of Adams, or the brilliance of Muller, for what would such a change do but make them no longer Adams and Muller? I would have them be they, and yet have the results different. If one could go back in time, what small change then might produce a large and desirable change now? That's what's needed. Time travel. Ah, that grinds a reaction out of you, Muller. That was the clear beginning of a snort. Time travel. Ridiculous. Impossible. Not only impossible in the sense that the state of the art is inadequate for the purpose, but in the greater sense that it will be forever inadequate. Time travel, in the sense of going backward to change reality, is not only technologically impossible now, but it is theoretically impossible altogether. Odd you should think so, Muller, because your theories, those very analyses which have brought the four forces, even gravitation, measurably close to inclusion under the umbrella of a single set of relationships, make time travel no longer theoretically impossible. No, don't rise to protest. Keep your seat, Muller, and relax. For you, it is impossible, I'm sure. For most people, it would be. Perhaps for almost everyone. But there might be exceptions, and it just might be that I'm one of them. Why myself? Who knows? I don't claim to be brighter than either of you, but what has that to do with it? Let us argue by analogy. Consider. Tens of thousands of years ago, human beings, little by little, either as a mass endeavor or through the agency of a few brilliant individuals, learned to communicate. Speech was invented, and delicate modulations of sounds were invested with abstract meaning. For thousands of years, every normal human being has been able to communicate. But how many have been able to tell a story superlatively well? Shakespeare, Tolstoy, Dickens, Hugo, a handful compared to all the human beings who have lived, can use those modulated sounds to wrench at heartstrings and reach for sublimity. Yet they use the same sounds that all of us use. I am prepared to admit that Muller's IQ, for instance, is higher than that of Shakespeare or Tolstoy. Muller's knowledge of language must be as good as that of any writer alive. His understanding of meaning as great. Yet Muller could not put words together and achieve the effect that Shakespeare could. Muller himself wouldn't deny it for a moment, I'm sure. What then is it that Shakespeare and Tolstoy can do that Muller or Adams or I cannot? What wisdom do they have that we cannot penetrate? You don't know, and I don't know. What is worse, they didn't know. Shakespeare could in no manner have instructed you, or anyone, how to write as he did. He didn't know how. He merely could. Next, consider the consciousness of time. As far as we can guess, only human beings of all life forms can grasp the significance of time. All other species live in the present only, might have vague memories, might have dim and limited forethought, but surely only human beings truly understand the past, present, and future, and can speculate on its meaning and significance, can wonder about the flow of time, of how it carries us along with it, and of how that flow might be altered. When did this happen? How did it come about? Who was the first human being, or hominid, that suddenly grasped the manner in which the river of time carried him from the dim past into the dim future, and wondered if it might be dammed or diverted? The flow is not invariant. Time races for us at times. Hours vanish in what seem like minutes, and lag unconscionably at other times. In dream states, in trances, in drug experiences, time alters its properties. You seem about to comment, Adams. Don't bother. You are going to say that those alterations are purely psychological. I know it. But what else is there but the psychological? Is there physical time? If so, what is physical time? Surely it is whatever we choose to make it. We design the instruments. We interpret the measurements. We create the theories and then interpret those. And from absolute, we have changed time and made it the creature of the speed of light and decided that simultaneity is indefinable. From your theory, Muller, we know that time is altogether subjective. In theory, someone understanding the nature of the flow of time can, given enough talent, move with or against the flow independently, or stand still in it. It is analogous to the manner in which, given the symbols of communication, someone, given enough talent, can write King Lear. Given enough talent. What if I had enough talent? What if I could be the Shakespeare of the time flow? Come, let us amuse ourselves. At any moment, the message from the Board of Trustees will arrive, and I will have to stop. Until it does, however, allow me to push along with my chatter. It serves its turn. Come, I doubt that you were aware that 15 minutes has passed since I began talking. Think, then. If I could make use of Muller's theory, and find within myself the odd ability to take advantage of it, as Homer did of words, what would I do with my gift? I might wander back through time, perhaps. Wraith-like, observing from without all the pattern of time and events, in order to reach in at one place or another and make a change. Oh, yes, I would be outside the time stream as I travel. Your theory, Muller, properly interpreted, does not insist that, in moving backward in time or forward, one must move through the thick of the flow, stumbling across events and knocking them down in passage. That would indeed be theoretically impossible. To remain outside is where the possibility comes in, and to slip in and out at will is where the talent comes in. Suppose, then, I did this, that I slipped in and made a change. That one change would breed another, which would breed another. Time would be set in a new path, which would take on a life of its own, curving and foaming until, in a very little time... No, that is an inadequate expression. Time would, in a very little time. It is as though we are imagining some abstract and absolute time-like reference against which our time may be measured, as though our own background of time were flowing against another deeper background. I confess it's beyond me, but pretend you understand. Any change in the events of time would, after a while, alter everything unrecognizably. But I wouldn't want that. I told you at the start, I do not wish to cease to be me. Even if in my place I would create someone who was more intelligent, more sensible, more successful, it would still not be me. Nor would I want to change you, Muller, or you, Adams. I've said that already, too. I would not want to triumph over a Muller who is less ingenious and spectacularly bright, or over an Adams who has been less politic and deft at putting together an imposing structure of respect. I would want to triumph over you as you are, and not over lesser beings. Well, yes, it is triumph, I wish. Oh, come. You stir as though I had said something unworthy. Is a sense of triumph so alien to you? Are you so dead to humanity that you seek no honor, no victory, no fame, no rewards? Am I to suppose that the respected Professor Adams does not wish to possess his long list of publications, his revered string of honorary degrees, his numerous medals and plaques, his post as head of one of the most prestige-filled departments of physics in the world? And would you be satisfied to have all that, Adams, if no one were to know of it? If its existence were to be wiped out of all records and histories? If it were to remain a secret between you and the Almighty? A silly question. I certainly won't demand an answer when we all know what it would be. And I needn't go through the same rigmarole of inquiry concerning Muller's potential Nobel Prize. and what seems like a certain university presidency, and of this university, too. What is it you both want in all of this, considering that you want not only the things themselves, but the public knowledge of your ownership of these things? Surely you want triumph. You want triumph over your competitors as an abstract class. Triumph over your fellow human beings. You want to do something others cannot do, and to have all those others know that you have done something they cannot do, so that they must then look up at you in helpless awareness of that knowledge and in envy and enforced admiration. Shall I be more noble than you? Why? Let me have the privilege of wanting what you want, of hungering for the triumph you have hungered for. Why should I not want the long respect, the great prize, the high position that waits on you two? And to do so in your place, to snatch it from you at the moment of its attainment. It is no more disgraceful for me to glory in such things than for you to do so. Ah, but you deserve it, and I do not. There is precisely the point. What if I could so arrange the flow and content of time as to have me deserve it and you not? Imagine. I would still be I, the two of you, the two of you. You would be no less worthy, and I no more worthy. That being the condition I have set myself, that none of us change. And yet I deserve, and you do not. I want to beat you, in other words, as you are, and not as inferior substitutes. In a way, that is a tribute to you, isn't it? I see from your expression you think it is. I imagine you both feel a kind of contemptuous pride. It is something, after all, to be the standard by which victory is measured. You enjoy earning the merits I lust for, especially if that lust must go unsatisfied. I don't blame you for feeling so. In your place, I would feel the same. But must the lust go unsatisfied? Think it out. Suppose I were to go back in time, say 25 years. A nice figure, an even quarter century. You, Adams, would be 40. You would have just arrived here, a full professor, from your stint at Case Institute. You would have done your work in diamagnetics, though your unreported effort to do something with bismuth hypochromite had been a rather laughable failure. Heavens, Adams, don't look so surprised. Do you think I don't know your professional life to the last detail? And as for you, Muller, you were 26, and just in the process of turning out a doctor's thesis on general relativity, which was fascinating at the time, but is much less satisfying in retrospect than it was at the time. Had it been correctly interpreted, it would have anticipated most of Hawking's later conclusions, as you now know. You did not correctly interpret it at the time, and you have successfully managed to hide that fact. I'm afraid, Muller, you are not good at interpretation. You did not interpret your own doctor's thesis to its best advantage, and you have not properly interpreted your great field theory. Perhaps, Muller, it isn't a disgrace either. The lack of interpretation is a common event. We can't all have the interpretive knack, and the talent to shake loose consequences may not occur in the same mind that possesses the talent for brilliance of concept. I have the former without the latter, so why should you not have the latter without the former? If you could only create your marvelous thoughts, Muller, and leave it to me to see the equally marvelous conclusions. What a team we would make, you and I, Muller. But you wouldn't have me. I don't complain about that, for I wouldn't have you. In any case, these are trifles. I could in no way damage you, Adams, with the pinprick of your silly handling of the bismuth salts. After all, you did with some difficulty catch your mistake before you embalmed it in the pages of a learned journal, if you could have gotten past the referees. And I could not cloud the sunshine that plays on you, Muller, by making a point of your failure to deduce what might be deduced from your concepts. It might even be looked upon as a measure of your brilliance, that so much crowded into your thoughts that even you were not bright enough to wring them dry of consequence. But if that would not do, what would? How could matters be changed properly? Fortunately, I could study the situation for a length of something that my consciousness would interpret as years, and yet there would be no physical time passage, and therefore no aging. My thought processes would continue, but my physical metabolism would not. You smile again. No, I don't know how that could be. Surely our thought processes are part of our metabolic changes. I can only suppose that outside the time stream, thought processes are not thought processes in the physical sense, but are something else that is equivalent. And if I study a moment in time and search for a change that will accomplish what I want it to accomplish, how could I do that? Could I make a change, move forward in time, study the consequences, and, if I didn't like it, move back, unchange the change, and try another? If I did it 50 times, 1,000 times, could I ever find the right change? The number of changes, each with numberless consequences, each with further numberless consequences, is beyond computation or comprehension. How could I find the change I was seeking? Yet I could. I could learn how, and I can't tell you how I learned or what I did after I learned. Would it be so difficult? Think of the things we do learn. We stand. We walk. We run. We hop. And we do it all even though we are tipped on end. We are in an utter state of instability. We remain standing only because the large muscles of our legs and torso are forever lightly contracting and pulling this way and that, like a circus performer balancing a stick on the end of his nose. Physically, it's hard. That is why standing still takes it out of us and makes us glad to sit down after a while. That is why standing at attention for an unfairly long period of time will lead to collapse. Yet except when we take it to extremes, we do it so well, we're not even aware we do it. We can stand and walk and run and hop and start and stop all day long, and never fall or even become seriously unsteady. Well then, describe how you do it, so that someone who has never tried can do it. You can't. Another example. We can talk. We can stretch and contract the muscles of our tongue and lips and cheeks and palate in a rapid and unrhythmic set of changes that produce just the modulation of sound that we want. It was hard enough to learn when we were infants, but once we learned, we could produce dozens of words a minute without any conscious effort. Well, how do we do it? What changes do we produce to say, how do we do it? Describe those changes to someone who has never spoken, so that he can make that sound. It can't be done. But we can make the sound, and without effort, too. Given enough time, I don't even know how to describe the passage of what I mean. It was not time. Call it duration. Given enough duration without the passage of time, I learned how to adjust reality as desired. It was like a child babbling, but gradually learning to pick and choose among the babbles to construct words. I learned to choose. It was risky, of course. In the process of learning, I might have done something irreversible, or at least something which, for reversal, would have required subtle changes that were beyond me. I did not. Perhaps it was more good fortune than anything else. And I came to enjoy it. It was like the painting of a picture, the construction of a piece of sculpture. It was much more than that. It was the carving of a new reality. A new reality unchanged from our own in key ways. I remained exactly what I am. Adams remained the eternal Adams. Muller, the quintessential Muller. The university remained the university. Science, science. Well then, did nothing change? But I'm losing your attention. You no longer believe me, and if I am any judge, feel scornful with what I'm saying. I seem to have slipped in my enthusiasm, and I have begun acting as though time travel were real, and that I have really done what I would like to do. Forgive me. Consider it imagination, fantasy. I say what I might have done, if time travel were real, and if I truly had the talent for it. In that case, in my imagination, did nothing change? There would have to be some change. One that would leave Adams exactly Adams, and yet unfit to be head of the department. Muller to be precisely Muller, and yet without any likelihood of becoming university president, and without much chance of being voted the Nobel Prize. And I would have to be myself, unlovable and plodding, and unable to create, and yet possessing the qualities that would make me university president. It could be nothing scientific, It would have to be something outside science, something disgraceful and sordid that would disqualify you fine gentlemen. Come now, I don't deserve those looks of mingled disdain and smug self-satisfaction. You are sure, I take it, that you can do nothing disgraceful and sordid. How can you be sure? There's not one of us who, if conditions were right, would not slip into, shall we call it, sin? Who among us would be without sin, given the proper temptation? Who among us is without sin? Think, think. Are you sure your souls are pure? Have you done nothing wrong, ever? Have you never at least nearly fallen into the pit? And if you have, was it not a narrow escape, brought about more through some fortunate circumstance than inner virtue? And if someone had closely studied all your actions, and noted the strokes of fortune that kept you safe, and deflected just one of them, might you not then have done wrong? Of course, if you had lived openly foul and sordid lives, so that people turned from you in disdain and disgust, you would not have reached your present states of reverence. You would have fallen long since, and I would not have to step over your disgraced bodies, for you would not be here to serve me as stepping stones. You see how complex it all is? But then, it is all the more exciting, you see. If I were to go back in time and find that the solution was not complex, that in one stroke I could achieve my aim, I might manage to gain pleasure out of it, but there would be a lack of intellectual excitement. If we were to play chess, and I were to win by a fool's mate in 3 moves, it would be a victory that was worse than defeat. I would have played an unworthy opponent, and I would be disgraced for having done so. No. The victory that is worthwhile is the one snatched slowly and with pain from the reluctant grip of the adversary, a victory that seems unattainable, a victory that is as wearying, as torturing, as hopelessly bone-breaking as the worst and most tedious defeat, but that has, as its difference, the fact that while you are panting and gasping in total exhaustion, it is the flag you hold in your hand, the trophy. The duration I spent playing with that most intractable of all materials, reality, was filled with the difficulty I had set myself. I insisted stubbornly not only on having my aim, but on my having that aim my way, on rejecting everything that was not exactly as I wanted it to be. A near miss, I considered a miss. An almost hit, I eliminated as not a hit. In my target, I had a bullseye and nothing else. And even after I won, it would have to be a victory so subtle that you would not know I had won until I had carefully explained it to you. To the final moment, you would not know your life had been turned wrong end up. That is what... But wait. I have left out something. I have been so caught up in the intensity of my intention of leaving us and the university and science all the same, that I have not explained that other things might indeed change. There would be bound to be changes in social, political, and economic forces, and in international relationships. Who would care about such things after all? Certainly not we three. That is the marvel of science and the scientist, is it not? What is it to us whom we elect in our dear United States? Or what votes were taken in the United Nations? Or whether the stock market went up or down? Or whether the unending pavan of the nations followed this pattern or that? As long as science is there, and the laws of nature hold fast, and the game we play continues, the background against which we play it is just a meaningless shifting of light and shadow. Perhaps you don't feel this openly, Muller. I know well you have, in your time, felt yourself part of society, and have placed yourself on record with views on this and that. To a lesser extent, so did you, Adams. Both of you have had exalted views concerning humanity and the earth and various abstractions. How much of that, however, was a matter of greasing your conscience because inside, deep inside, you don't really care as long as you can sit brooding over your scientific thoughts? That's one big difference between us. I don't care what happens to humanity as long as I am left to my physics. I am open about it. Everyone knows me as cynical and callous. You two secretly don't care. To the cynicism and callousness that characterize me, you add hypocrisy, which plasters over your sins to the unthinking, but makes them worse when found out. Oh, don't shake your heads. In my searching out your lives, I discovered as much about you as you yourselves know. More, since I see your peccadilloes clearly, and you two hide them even from yourselves. It is the most amusing thing about hypocrisy, that once it is adhered to sternly enough, it numbers the hypocrite himself among its victims. He is his own chief victim, in fact, for it is quite usual that when the hypocrite is exposed to all the world, he still seems, quite honestly, a plaster saint to himself. But I tell you this not in order to vilify you. I tell it to you in order to explain that if I found it necessary to change the world in order to keep ourselves all the same, yet place me on top instead of you, you wouldn't really mind. Not about the world, that is. You wouldn't mind if the Republicans were up and the Democrats were down, or vice versa. If feminism was in flower and professional sports were under a cloud. If this fashion or that in clothing, furniture, music, or comedy was in or out. What would any of that matter to you? Nothing. In fact, less than nothing. For if the world were changed, it would be a new reality. The reality, as far as people in the world were concerned. The only reality. The reality of the history books. The reality that was real over the last 25 years. If you believed me, if you thought I were spinning more than a fantasy, you would still be helpless. Could you go to someone in authority and say, "This is not the way things are supposed to be. It has been altered by a villain." What would that prove but that you were insane? Who could believe that reality is not reality, when it is the fabric and tapestry that has been woven all these 25 years in incredibly intricate fashion, and when everyone remembers and lives it as woven? But you yourselves do not believe me. You dare not believe that I am not merely speculating about having gone back into the past, about having studied you both, about having labored to bring about a new reality in which we are unchanged, but alas, the world is changed. I have done it. I have done it all. And I alone remember both realities because I was outside time when the change was made, and I made it. And still you don't believe me. You dare not believe me, for you yourselves would feel you were insane if you did. Could I have altered this familiar world of 1982? Impossible. If I did, what could the world have been like before I tampered with it? I'll tell you. It was chaotic. It was full of license. People were laws to themselves. In a way, I'm glad I changed it. Now we have a government, and the land is governed. Our rulers have views, and the views are enforced. Good. But, gentlemen, in that world that was, that old reality that no one can know or conceive, you two gentlemen were laws to yourselves, and fought for license and anarchy. It was no crime in the old reality. It was admirable to many. In the new reality, I left you unchanged. You remained fighters for license and anarchy, and that is a crime in the present reality. The only reality you know. I made sure you could cover it up. No one knew about your crimes, and you were able to rise to your present height. But I knew where the evidence was, and how it might be uncovered, and at the proper time, I uncovered it. Now I think that for the first time I catch expressions on your faces that don't ring the changes of weary tolerance, of contempt, of amusement, of annoyance. Do I catch a whiff of fear? Do you remember what I am talking about? Think! Think! Who were members of the League of Constitutional Freedoms? Who helped circulate the Free Thought Manifesto? It was very brave and honorable of you to do this, some people thought. You were much applauded by the underground. Come, come, you know whom I mean by the underground. You're not active in it any longer. Your position is too exposed, and you have too much to lose. You have position and power, and there is more on the way. Why risk it for something that people don't want? You wear your pendants, and you're numbered among the godly. But my pendant is larger, and I am more godly, for I have not committed your crimes. What is more, gentlemen, I get the credit of having informed against you. A shameful act? A scandalous act? My informing? Not at all. I shall be rewarded. I have been horrified at the hypocrisy of my colleagues. disgusted and nauseated at their subversive past, concerned for what they might be plotting now against the best and noblest and most godly society ever established on earth. As a result, I brought all this to the attention of the decent men who helped conduct the policies of that society in true sobriety of thought and humility of spirit. They will wrestle with your evils to save your souls and to make you true children of the Spirit. There will be some damage to your bodies in the process, I imagine. But what of that? It would be a trivial cost compared to the vast and eternal good they will bring you. And I shall be rewarded for making it all possible. I think you are really frightened now, gentlemen. For the message we have all been waiting for is now coming. And you see now why I have been asked to remain here with you. The presidency is mine. And my interpretation of the Mueller theory, combined with the disgrace of Mueller, will make it the Dinsmore theory in the textbooks and may bring me the Nobel Prize. As for you... There was the sound of footsteps in cadence outside the door. A ringing cry of, "Halt!" The door was flung open. In stepped a man whose sober gray garb, wide white collar, tall buckled hat, and large bronze cross proclaimed him a captain in the dreaded Legion of Decency. He said, nasally,
"Horatio Adams, I arrest you in the name of God and the congregation for the crime of devilry and witchcraft. Karl Mueller, I arrest you in the name of God and the congregation for the crime of devilry and witchcraft."
His hand beckoned briefly and quickly. Two legionnaires from the ranks came up to the two physicists, who sat in stupefied horror in their chairs, yanked them to their feet, placed cuffs on their wrists, and with an initial gesture of humility to the sacred symbol, tore the small crosses that were pendant from their lapels. The captain turned to Dinsmore.
"Yours in sanctity, sir. I have been asked to deliver this communication from the Board of Trustees."
"Yours in sanctity, Captain," said Dinsmore gravely, fingering his own pendant cross. "I rejoice to receive the words of those godly men." He knew what the communication contained. As the new president of the university, he might, if he chose, lighten the punishment of the two men. His triumph would be enough, even so. But only if it were safe. And in the grip of the moral majority, he must remember, no one was ever truly safe.